This morning, I am going to continue the theme of discipleship we have been hearing in Epiphany. We will look at discipleship through two lenses, one much needed and the other a trap: forgiveness and idolatry. You thought I was going to talk about adultery, didn't you? Our gospel is full of provocations this morning, and that's good. It's like the question we heard and discussed at our tables just 3 weeks ago at our annual meeting. As a reminder, I quote, "In the context of the political division in our country, how do we conduct ourselves as people of faith who are also responsible citizens? It is very easy to try to make things better and end up making things very much worse. Conflict and division are not new. The hell of fire in this passage that we just heard is a translation of the Greek word Gehenna, which refers to the burning garbage heap outside of town. In other words, if you call somebody a fool, you are calling yourself garbage. There is no we and they, there is only us, and that us is God's field, God's building, God's servants. So my first focus is on forgiveness. In a few minutes, we will make our communal confession and ask for forgiveness. In the Lord's Prayer, we will promise to forgive others as we have been forgiven. Forgiveness. Forgiveness is a conscious, deliberate decision to release feelings of resentment or vengeance toward a person or group who has harmed you, regardless of whether they actually deserve your forgiveness. That's the definition. Some of the synonyms are fascinating. Forgiveness is pardon, absolution, condoning, vindication. I like shrift. I've never given anybody long shrift. In our prayer book, we have a service that I don't think is used very regularly, which is called Reconciliation of a Penitent. It's in there. It is an opportunity for an individual to lay down their burden and experience forgiveness. There is one line in that service where the penitent is asked, "Do you then forgive those who have sinned against you?" This comes after promising to turn again to Christ. That turn is a good clue for one of the necessary steps for us in forgiveness. Not many other steps are laid out for us. Throughout the Gospels, we often see Jesus telling people that they are forgiven and not to sin anymore. I have been thinking for months about how I am to practice forgiving, to develop my forgiveness muscle, and have this be something I do well. I know forgiveness does not mean that everything is okay. 30 years ago this week, Nelson Mandela was released from prison in South Africa. He had been in prison nearly my entire life. 5 years later, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was formed with Archbishop Desmond Tutu and other South African leaders. The commission was set up after the end of apartheid to address the violence and torture during decades of minority white supremacist rule. Anyone who was a victim of violence was free to make an accusation and to face their perpetrators. Perpetrators who admitted their participation could face their accusers, hear them, and tell their own testimonies. This was a crucial step for South Africa as they transitioned to a full and free democracy. The mandate of the commission was to bear witness, to record, and in some cases grant amnesty to the perpetrators of crimes relating to human rights violations, reparation, and rehabilitation. The commission was charged with restoring victims' dignity and formulating proposals to assist with rehabilitation. Out of over 7,000 cases, almost 900 were granted amnesty. When a victim is heard and a perpetrator is given an opportunity to make amends, cycles of violence and retribution break. That is as close as I can get to an algorithm of forgiveness. It is not perfect, and it does not guarantee that everything will be okay. However, if there is any release of resentment, what a freedom that is. On a smaller level, my EFM class in Colorado was once painfully divided. Most of us were on one side of an issue, and one individual was on the other. I was new to mentoring, and I was lost as to how to deal with this divide. Finally, the individual asked me if he could address the group. He had prepared a large poster board, his own hierarchy of needs. It was a pyramid, like Maslow's, for how to get along as companion disciples, as a Christian group, with disagreements. Community was the base of his pyramid, and he was lonely. He needed us. He needed to be heard and to hear us without being judged. By doing this, he helped the resentments to be released, and we moved forward as a unified group, as a we. And that is why I've long been intrigued by the instructions from Jesus at the start of our gospel about leaving your gift at the altar if your brother or sister has something against you. That one sentence has been with me for years, and I have reflected on it over and over. Historically, the altar in question is the temple in Jerusalem, where worship is still centralized for Judeans. The gift would have been an animal or birds. And I have to admit, if every one of Jesus' followers went to the temple and bought their animal or their birds and went to the altar and then just left them there and released them and went off to make amends and find reconciliation, all those animals set free, flying around, baaing and chirping in the temple while the people go and do their work of reconciliation. Real discipleship means forgiving and asking for forgiveness, not whether your sheep is unblemished. What gift do we offer when we are really asked to give ourselves? There was a point in time thinking about that sentence where I thought it meant I was not supposed to take communion. I literally fasted from communion for a long time because there was someone who had something against me, and I didn't know how to fix it. So my last thoughts on forgiveness are that sometimes the release is personal and private. Perhaps someone has died and the relationship has changed. Perhaps someone is toxic and it is only more abusive to try to reconcile. In 2006, I heard Sister Helen Prejean and Miroslav Volf speaking about the anatomy of reconciliation, about turning from violence to healing. Volf, who grew up in Croatia, told a story about a man who had been captured and tortured in the conflict in the former Yugoslavia. Long after his release, this man realized the torture was ongoing in his mind. Volf said that the man came to see his mind as a house with different rooms, and his torturer was in the living room. The violence could never be undone, but what this man could do was move his torturer out of the front room and into the basement in his mind. And after that, this man was free. Resentments are just a way of using our memory to turn the weapon that hurt us on ourselves. According to Volf, the proper goal of memory should be reconciliation, an embrace which includes justice. Volf proposes that the memory of Christ's passion and reconciliation and resurrection, which we do every week, should guide Christians' rememberings of wrongs committed and suffered. We don't tell a story of a victim. We tell the story of the victor. This is freedom and release and reconciliation. I would like to give you two assignments for forgiveness. First, I'd love for you to say the Lord's Prayer at home and substitute the name of someone for whom you need to pray because of resentment, or perhaps because they are gone. This week, my bonus grandmother died, so I'm going to put her name in. I'm going to say, Billy's father, who art in heaven. Hallowed be thy name. Give Billy this day her daily bread. Forgive Billy her trespasses. Lead Billy not into temptation. Deliver Billy from evil. You get the idea. This prayer can be hard. There's some names I don't want to say out loud sometimes. I admit that. But try it. I'm sure you can think of someone or perhaps a pain you're experiencing in your body. Pray to that. Secondly, today, before you go to the altar, when we offer the peace, let's exercise our forgiveness muscles. Don't put anybody on the spot, but offer peace and forgiveness today during the peace. Let's see how that feels. Make your yes a true yes, because when we forgive each other, we are saying yes to God. The reason I'm suggesting that is that my second focus is idolatry. When we are consumed with resentment about somebody, that person looms larger than God. On the other side of that coin, as Paul has been telling us for a few weeks now in 1 Corinthians, when we elevate any person, some teacher or mentor or candidate or leader, Apollos or Paul, when we elevate them out of proportion to who they really are, they also loom larger than God. When we are free from resentment and misplaced adoration, to quote Dietrich Bonhoeffer, we only have one master now, but with this yes to God belongs just as clear a no. Your yes to God requires your no to all injustice, to all evil, to all lies, to all oppression and violation of the weak and poor, to all ungodliness and to all mockery of what is holy. Your yes to God requires a no to everything that interferes with serving God alone, even if that is your job, your possessions, your home, or your honor in the world. End of the quote. I believe this is the real adultery Jesus was warning against, those things that tear us from our love of God and neighbor. Our conversations together in this fraught year must be framed by our yes to God and our no to injustice. If we hit that wall of disagreement, if our brother or sister has something against us, I hope we can all root ourselves in the words of the prayers we are about to pray this morning. Let us set aside anything in us that is not God's. For as we prayed at the start of our service, we can do nothing good without God. Let us be God's servants, God's field, God's building of the body of Christ. We are forgiven. Forgive one another and bring your unique gift, your very self, to our altar and be filled with the gifts Christ has given us.